Six music.
BBC Radio. Six music documentaries.
Welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. To kick off this new series, we have the lead guitarist, producer, founder and architect of one of the biggest and arguably greatest heavy rock bands of all time, who from their formation in 1968 set new parameters for what a rock band could achieve in terms of record sales, touring, musicianship, excess and artistic ambition. My guest this week on The First Time is Mr. Jimmy Page. Here at the start of Led Zeppelin's epic album reissue campaign, Jimmy talks to me about his earliest influences and his passion for the bluesmen of the 50s, going on to his time spent as a young session guitarist in the London scene of the early 60s, and on to his master plan to form the greatest rock band ever to stalk the earth. Normally a somewhat reclusive and private figure, Jimmy also discusses Zepp's unique musical chemistry, the scale of their achievements, their now legendary one-off reunion in 2007, and the impact of drummer John Bonham's death in 1980. But I started by asking Jimmy, as I do with all my guests, when he was first aware of music.
I must have been really pretty young, about seven, eight, something like that. I was living in Feltham at the time, and my parents were friendly with somebody down the road, although this particular thing only happened once, and he'd just got a stereo system. And I remember hearing this stuff, stereo, the music in stereo, because of course we had a radio like everybody else had, but the single speaker. And it was quite a revelation to the whole sonic picture of everything and how it opened up. So I've got to say that really sort of hit me at the time, and you know, it sort of went into everything that sort of, I guess it'll almost be in my DNA imprint at the end of the day. So it was that, but then more so the sort of music that was being played in the 50s, without doubt, is going to be Lonnie Donegan.
Now this here's a story about the Rock Island Line. The Rock Island Line, she runs down into New Orleans. And just outside of New Orleans, there's a big toll gate. You know, all the trains, they go through the toll gate while they got to pay the man some money. But of course, if you've got certain things on board, you're okay.
All of that stuff, I guess it was a spirit of what rock and roll was, and this whole sort of manifestation of youth, really, and its application to music. And, you know, I just went out there and I was just one of the people who got really, really captivated and seduced by it. And to the point where, thanks to Lonnie Donegan, because it looked as though it was possible, you know, to be able to sort of just know a few chords and strum and be able to do these things. I mean, that was the access point, I do believe, for so many of the guitarists from that point of time, and certainly I was one of them.
Now tell you where I'm going, boy. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road.
You know, then that led on to sort of getting records and trying to learn from records, because that was the only way to learn. There wasn't the great wealth of information that there is now. If you want to know how to play a song, you can just go on the internet and see, you know, how it's done and watch the person's fingers and see the charts. In those days, it was every man for himself.
Where did you first hear Scotty Moore? Because, I mean, it's someone that you've talked about a lot. I think, was it Baby Let's Play House, said, was one of those songs.
Yeah, it was one of those sort of pivotal points, but just hearing those really early records, recordings that Sam Phillips had made of Elvis, and at that point of realisation that, you know, there's a sort of strumming of the guitar, which you had Elvis doing, but realising that there was just guitar and an upright bass, which is really rhythmic, and then these wonderful guitar parts from Scotty Moore that were just absolutely incredible. The chemistry of the three of them was just superb. You can hear the enthusiasm of them. Well, yeah, that's all of that.
Baby. Come back, baby. I wanna play house with you. Well, you may go to college, you may go to school, you may have a pink Cadillac, but don't you be nobody's fool. And now, baby, come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby. I wanna play house with you.
Now, listen, let me tell you, baby, what I'm talking about. Come on back to me, little girl, so we. Now this is one thing, baby, that I want you to know. House so we can act like we did before. But so baby, come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, I wanna play out with you.
Hit it.
Yeah. better than to be with another man. And then the baby, come back, baby, gone.
Yeah, you know, it gets a little bit, you know, even more technical by hearing Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps. And then you hear something like Train Kept a Rolling, which is really, really almost an avant-garde approach to guitar. All of it, you know, but once I started playing, I had a voracious appetite for guitar playing and styles of character playing. Then, you know, I started to listen to, you know, acoustic, flamenco, you know, a little bit of jazz guitar, but mainly it was the blues, hearing that Chicago, that whole movement of Chicago blues and that sort of riffing and, you know, this almost like trance music that was going on, and all of those things were major to my sort of, I guess, development and learning and wanting to sort of play and emulate.
I find it amazing that you and a couple of other sort of guitarists, all kind of in the same area of London, these young sort of skinny white guys got really into like Muddy Waters and Howling Wolf. Yes. It seems like a different world.
Yeah, as it went on, it was as more things became available to you know, via record collectors as well. Because quite clearly, you know, none of this stuff was really being played on the radio airwaves. Even if you were listening to American Forces Network or whatever, they weren't playing sort of Muddy Waters, were they?
What would be the Muddy Waters track that you can remember really first making a big impression on you?
There's two. There's I Can't Be Satisfied, which is the, you know, bottleneck one, and that's just him and a bass player.
Well, I'm going away to live, won't be back no more. Going back down south, child, don't you wanna go? When I'm trouble, I be all.
And then Standing Around Crying, which is one with Little Walter on harmonica. And as much as the technical playing, it was a whole atmosphere and performance that really got me as much as anything else, you know? That was just so eerie and, oh my goodness gracious. I'm now getting chills thinking about that one.
Standing around crying. Oh, baby, look how you got me standing around crying. On my mind. Oh, baby, I ain't gonna be riding around in my automobile. Oh, baby, you ain't
to be.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, here on 6 Music. I'm a guest this week from Led Zeppelin, Mr. Jimmy Page. And before that, you heard Muddy Waters Standing Around Crying from 1952, one of Jimmy's favourite records. Now, while still in his teens, Jimmy became a respected session guitarist, featuring on recordings by countless artists, including the Nashville Teens, Burt Bacharach, Tom Jones, Marianne Faithfull, and the Kinks. I asked him if he remembered his first ever guitar session.
First session that I did, I think, is, well, I know to be one that was really like a hit parade number, was Diamonds. Chet Harris and Tony Meehan, and I played acoustic guitar on that.
Cause, I mean, the myth is like you were doing three or four sessions a day.
Yeah, well, there was quite a space then between that and Carter Lewis and the Southerners. But with the Carter Lewis and the Southerners record, which sort of... there was more guitar playing on the B-side than the A-side that got into the charts. But somehow I got picked up on from that point. And then I got invited to a lot of studio dates.
Focused young man, very driven young man at that time to do all that stuff.
Yeah. No, the truth of it was that it was a very closed shop, the studio musicians at the time. Mm. I mean, it really was. It was the same studio musicians doing quite a number of sessions, you know. And I was the new kid on the block. I was probably 7 years younger than anybody else who was in there, but the fact that I'd embraced so many, or attempted to play so many different styles of music, you know, from the fingerstyle guitar playing and various approaches to the electric guitar, you know, they sort of embraced me and took me in. And plus, I could also play harmonica as well, so I managed to fulfil a lot of sort of slots, if you like.
So being in all these studios, when did you start to think about the potential of the studio, this idea of kind of experimenting and capturing sound and dynamic? When did that start to really open up to you?
Where I was first affected by it was listening to these recordings of... again, you know, Sam Phillips, there are numerous sort of aspects to this, but, you know, the whole sort of echo techniques that he used, and the vocal sounds that he would get with Elvis, and the guitar sound and the repeat echoes and things that Scotty Moore had, and even more so that sort of intensity of recording and performance of the Chicago blues, especially the Chess records, you know. Obviously, it was Chuck Berry that was just the ultimate. At the time, hearing Chuck Berry as, you know, the complete guitarist, singer, songwriter, and those performances on his records were just fantastic. And certainly the sort of stuff that you wanted to see if you could play that and work on it, get the records and keep moving the pickup arm backwards and forwards while you tried to practice the stuff. But the recorded sound of these things and also the aspect of compressors and limiters, the sort of thing that Joe Meek was doing, all of this, I'd done little sort of home recordings myself, but once I actually got into the real professional world of recording, and I was able to sort of see how things were sort of really done as opposed to how I imagined that they might be done, I spent a lot of time paying attention to what they were doing. I mean, all in all, that whole sort of three-year period when I was a studio musician, it served as an apprenticeship, really, because I went in there just sort of busking, really, and they'd say, oh, you know, can you sort of put a riff or some phrases or play what you want along this in the early stages, which was great, you know.
Long as I have you, long as I have you,
I've kind of got of the first Zeppelin rehearsal is of these four young guys doing Train Kept a Rolling and As Long As I Have You and just looking at each other going, the potential here is amazing. Was it like that? Was it a case of we've discovered something? The potential here is enormous.
Well, when I came from the Yardbirds, I had a very, very clear idea of what I hoped to get together as a band. I heard Robert sing with a band that he had in the Midlands. He'd been recommended by Terry Reid. And I'd got Robert to come to my house. He came down and he had a look at my records and thought, well, that's interesting. He's got some, you know, they're pretty akin to some of mine, you know. And I played him certain ideas of what I wanted to be doing within this new band. I played him Dazed and Confused and Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You and these sort of things, and Communication Breakdown. I know I like the chorus, I had the riff and the words for the chorus and all that. So there was quite a little sort of structure appearing of what I'd like to do. And the great thing was he was really open to it, which was really cool, you know. So there was quite an affinity straight from the start. But the fact that when we actually got, because I went to listen to John Bonham playing with Tim Rose, and I'd come across John Paul Jones in the session world, and he was still doing sessions at that point. But when we got into the rehearsal, I mean, it was just, you just knew instinctively that this was something that no one in the band had played with, this sort of lineup before, and this combination, and we were all strong individually, but playing as a band like that, we just knew that it was so right to go ahead. And so then everyone came to my house and we rehearsed the first album and the set to which we'd go out and play on the road with. Well, I say on the road, it was a limited road. It was in Scandinavia, a handful of dates, and then went into the into Olympic Studios and began recording the first album over a series of what dates were available to go in. So it was pretty fast. The dates in Scandinavia are September. We're recording in October. The album's finished in a matter of collectively sort of 30 hours.
Wow.
And we're doing a tour in America starting December, and by January we'd really done it. We'd really broken America. I mean, it's pretty astonishing stuff.
Was Communication Breakdown by Led Zeppelin, a live BBC session from March the 3rd, 1969.
This is Six Music.
Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music.
Thank you.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week from Led Zeppelin is Jimmy Page. And that was Communication Breakdown, the first track from Led Zepp's first ever album from 1969 called simply Led Zeppelin. When that first record came out, it's an incredible statement. It's such a sonically arresting record right from the off, from the very first song. You must have known before it was coming out going, this is going to blow people's minds.
Yeah, I knew that it ought to, if it got heard, because there were just so many different ideas and new statements within music, like the Babe, I'm Going to Leave You, and Dazed and Confused, and I mean, it just goes on and on and on, doesn't it? But there were just so many new approaches to things that people hadn't done before. And there it was collectively on a first album as a sort of showcase of this fantastic musicianship, and performances by, you know, each group member. On that rehearsal, what was quite clear was that the musical content and the power was something that none of us had experienced before. Well, I'd never played guitar like I did on the first album. I never had the... John Bonham, even though he had this incredible technique, had never had the opportunity to play like that. And likewise for John Paul Jones and certainly Robert. So there it was, you know, four musicians at the top of their game collectively playing as a phenomenal band with all these new ideas and textures and on this first album. Yeah, it was a really good... I knew it was a great debut album.
Really interests me is this point where a band moves out of the shadows of other bands and becomes doing something new, rather than like, you know, oh, we're playing this place another band has played, or we're following this band's album circle. All of a sudden, you're kind of somewhere no one's been before.
Well, it was a new approach to everything, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Everything that we're taking on there, even the blues and everything.
So could you sort of remember feeling for the first time like this is uncharted waters, no band's yes. ever gone here before?
Like Babe, I'm Going to Leave You, Dazed and Confused, I know that.
Yeah.
I knew that, but I'm sure we all knew that as well.
And the scale of it as well, I mean, as it got bigger and bigger and bigger, it must have been a point where like, this is, no one has had these arenas in the palm of their hand. No one's selling this many albums.
Yes, but what's quite important to say about the sort of studio releases of Led Zeppelin was that there's such a movement of the sort of growth and the maturity and the confidence within the band, within whatever we're approaching musically, to the point that, I mean, we've all heard about the bad reviews that we got for our albums. A good percentage of that came from the fact that as we weren't going to do singles, we weren't going to get anchored down to a singles market. So as you put out the third album from the second, you know, there'd be a sort of point of reference to A Whole Lot of Love. No, there wasn't going to be. We were just going to keep moving and moving and moving. And it was summing up where we were and where the writing was at that point of time. So where reviewers may have had only a short period to listen, because they maybe had half a dozen discs to albums to review, they just couldn't get their heads around what it was.
Yeah.
So, but that's good, because with the sort of talent of musicianship that we had, it was almost as if there was a sort of divine intervention that we should get together. There was also sort of a cosmic rule that we should be charting new music and pushing ahead. And quite clearly, we sort of did that. You know, that's the way that it comes out anyway.
Spend my days with a woman and child, smoke my stuff and drank all my wine. Made up my mind, make a new start. I'm going to California with an aching in my heart. Someone told me there's a girl out there with love in her eyes and flowers in her hair. I didn't see too many this time. The sun begin to awake. Come on, you. It seems that the rump of the mark's got a bunch on the nose and it's starting to flow. I think I might be seeing you. Throw me your line if I reach it in time. I see who up there.
You always took your privacy very, very seriously as a band, which I guess is kind of difficult if you're going to be hugely famous, is to maintain a sense of self and maybe protect yourself from everything that's going on, all this attention. Was that an intentional thing to make sure that you didn't get carried away, do too many interviews, give too much of the
Well, the beauty of it was that, you know, what you had to do was to make records and make sure they were really good, and we were really good at that. Quite honestly, you know, and then the live performances were such that because of the musicianship within the band, we were able to sort of, you know, mutate the songs to the point where each concert had different elements in it. So at the beginning of an American tour, we'd have our set list, but, you know, even two or three weeks into it, there were so many sort of various changes that were in the numbers that had come to be purely by playing on stage, because we were that confident and we were so synchronized that we could move things around, you know, during live performances. We were just fearless. And that just manifested in the next set of writing, because we're moving on so far, so rapidly. That's really what you had to do. The thing you didn't have to do was lots of press, because there wasn't that much around. You know, there were just a few publications over here, and they could be done in a day or 2 days, and that's it. You're on playing more. In fact, that's even if you weren't playing a concert that night.
Yeah.
But that's honestly how it was. You know, it was really about what it should be, which is playing music and making records. Mm.
Led Zeppelin finished in 1980 with the death of John Bonham. How long did it take you before you were able to kind of return to the business of looking after the catalogue or returning to those songs? Because that must have been hugely difficult.
I started playing after there was quite a, you know, a gap. I did some work with Chris Squire and Alan White from Yes, which was really good, and they're superb musicians. And that there was a number of tracks that were recorded. They were good. They didn't go, you know, much further. And then I took on the Death Wish soundtrack and all of that. But so I was sort of active in other areas, but there was also Coda that came out.
Mm.
And that was revisiting things that we had as various sort of outtakes at the time. And Coda was put together, and you know, it's got the gem of Bonzo's Montreux on that, which is just, that's just stunning, isn't it? As a, you know, a drum orchestra, it's fabulous. You know, so that's slightly different to what this current thing that I've done is, because that was just, that's just referring to all of the quarter inch rough mixes and alternate versions and things. But on Coda, no, it was remixing from the multi tracks. Was it? Yeah, it was difficult. Yeah, it wasn't easy at that point, but. But listening to the thing along the years, you know, hearing John's playing, it's just it just fills you with so much joy, because his playing is just a celebration of music, isn't it?
Because there was talk of doing another album, wasn't there, before he passed away? You were talking.
Yeah.
About, it wasn't the end of the road.
Oh no. Well, no. We've been talking about doing things with. With some real sort of punchy riffs to it. And, yeah. He and I work so well together.
It is the springtime of my loving, the second season I am glowing. You are the sunlight in my growing, so little warmth I've felt before. It isn't hard to feel me glow. I watch the fire that grew so low. Thank you.
speak to me only with your eyes. It is to you I feel this tune. Ain't so hard to recognize, though. These things are clear to all.
In terms of the 2007 reunion of getting back together for Armut Ertegun, do you remember the first time it was proposed? Because I almost imagine this Mexican standoff between everyone, kind of like, well, are we? Who's gonna say yes? Who's gonna say no? Can you remember when it was first proposed?
It was put forward, yeah. And when it appeared as though it was going to be really on the cards, because there'd been some, you know, chaotic things that had gone on, like. The Live Aid, and we only had like an hour's rehearsal, and we hadn't seen each other for ages. I mean, it was just going on a wing and a prayer. Something like Live Aid was probably the most wisest thing to do, was it? And the Atlantic 40th again was something which really wasn't us at our best. However, there was Jason playing, and Jason had played very, very well. It gave an opportunity to sort of show exactly what we were at and just wipe the slate clean of any of that sort of chaos that had appeared in the past, and just give a really good presentation of ourselves, and an honourable one too, and a dignified one, with Jason, you know, Jason the man being part of the band, you know, and it was clear that you'd need to put in a good amount of work so that we had the confidence between all of us, especially Jason, so that if we wanted to start moving the music around on the night, like we used to in Ed Zeppelin, and that whole sort of ethic as well, which does quite clearly happen on the O2. There's things that we didn't rehearse that go in there, within the songs. It was worth it. It was the right thing to do. So John Paul Jones and Jason and I put in, quite a few hours, but it was just so worth doing.
Yeah.
We all had this unit of the band, this sort of confidence and the cohesion and synergy, if you like.
So with these reissues, the press release says you've been working on them for 2.5 years.
No. The idea of the releases, or re-release of the catalogue, we did it 20 years ago, and that was all in line, really, with CD market. At this time, it almost you need to reassess how things are being listened to, I think, every 10 years. But we're now talking about a 20-year period. So we've remastered from the original analogue, and it's for all formats.
What about your own solo album? You've been talking about doing some solo stuff for ages.
Well, I've had a solo album out.
Yeah,
that was in 1988.
A new one.
You see, because so the whole time frame of that took, it's about 2 years, really, including Celebration Day. Hundreds of hours of listening of tapes, I might say. To get it right, to get the right companion version to the studio versions that we all know and love, really, So now all of the sonic side of everything is done, going right through to the album Coda with the companion disc. So it gives me time to work on the guitar, to be able to be seen to be playing. I mean, that's the essence of it. It doesn't matter, what I'm playing at home or whatever. It's more a question of being out there and being seen to be playing, so that's the next interesting challenge for me. It'll be full of surprises, I hope. I can't give too much away because I haven't got anybody in mind yet who I'm going to play with. Because the thing is, with all of this stuff that's been done, I just sort of really focus on things when I do things, and then now it's time to shift that focus into playing and manifesting the new music that I've got, and some previously heard music, same picture, but a very, very different ornate frame.
What's the last song we should play? We're going to finish on a song.
On what, from the re-releases?
From anything you like, sir.
I like you to play Whole Lot of Love because from the re-releases, because if the listeners haven't heard it yet, they're going to be in for a treat.
It's good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Love.
This is
Six Music.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.
Stay on my shore.